crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We've assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub. Well, what a guest we have for you right now. Let me tell you, it is a happy Walburgisnacht as witches dance around European bonfires. And we ask these questions. Does Satan drive a flying saucer? Are demons kidnapping humans and performing experiments on them? What's up with mutilations? Can demons transform into orbs or flying discs? Well, nobody knows more about this subject than Timothy Green Beckley. Some know him simply as Mr. UFO, and he has been doing this kind of research since he was a teenager. Just the other day, I was on the Paracast, and they said, yeah, you remind us of Tim Beckley, because, you know, I started when I was a teenager. He's been doing this since he was a teenager, and Tim Beckley, aside from the amazing, you know, spectrum of phenomena that he has researched, is also the only person who has gotten a bona fide photo of a man in black. And he's talked about that on the show before. A very eerie, creepy photo. And so it's fitting that he should, you know, explore even deeper into the mysteries of who they are, why they are here, and whether or not there is some spooky, demonic connection. Tim Beckley, welcome, my friend, to Speaking of Strange.
Hey, happy Walburgisnacht.
Yes.
You know, you got all my friends here revved up on Facebook after the show. Charlotte Sage, Ed, Dana and Sean, we're all going to go out and celebrate. I mean, we're just all just pumped up on this. I mean, any reason for me to celebrate, you know that. I wish Halloween was every weekend. In fact, since I'm also Mr. Creepo, it could very well be. You know, Sean, I think we met Josh on Walburgisnacht. We were up at that, remember, little film festival, and we were sitting there in the bar talking about all these little horror films, and you had made Inbred Rednecks, and neither you nor I realized who we were seated with.
Yeah, yeah.
Remarkable little experience, and I believe that was today, many, many years ago.
Really? I didn't even realize that
so this is a very, an extra special reason to go dancing naked through the woods.
So you and your
we
friends
could have well done that many years ago. Today, perhaps we will leave it to others more appealing. But good to be on the show again. You know, whether it's demons or angels, Speaking of Strange is one of the top shows in the country on the whole paranormal, and you are one of the top talk show hosts, as far as I'm concerned. So let's get on with the show.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And do you have anything orgiastic planned with your friends there?
Well, you can never tell how the evening usually turns into the daylight.
Yeah, it
and,
does.
It could very easily happen. You never know.
But we'll
make plans as the evening progresses.
Yeah. I'm sure. I think it's going to evolve in a number of unusual ways. And right now, of course, people all over the country are talking about this new publication that you have put out, Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer, because it's controversial. I mean, it crosses some lines and it makes people think about visitation in a whole new way. How would you describe this book?
Well, you know, I made a list. Well, let me go back to the beginning. When I started out, I had an organization, believe it or not, it was called the Interplanetary News Service. Of course, I'm a little bit gone beyond that point. I think it's some a point in time. Almost all of us who entered ufology thought that flying saucers had to be from Alpha Centauri or some other place. But today, I believe perhaps only Stanton Friedman adheres to that strict belief. little by little, we began to believe, based on the weight of evidence, that there might be some physical craft indeed involved. But there were a lot. There's a lot more attached to the subject than just nuts and bolts objects from outer space. I received a letter one day, or actually I received a series of letters. In those days, of course, people didn't have the Internet, and they would pass around copies of all kinds of little mimeographed and dittoed publications. There was a fellow who lived in Wyoming by the name of William C. Lamb. Now, William C. Lamb, in fact, this is a part of the Project Blue Book files, some of his correspondence, and Jacques Vallée even mentions it in... I think a passport to Magonia. Anyway, William C. Land was a devout Christian, and he had an experience that dates back to 1933. He was out hunting. Now, that's a very Christian thing to do. He was out hunting very early in the morning. I guess all hunters get up around 5 or 6 a.m. And he was out in a field, and he saw this tremendous light, something like right out of Close Encounters up above. Little by little, the object descended, hovered a few feet above the ground, and by this time he had already started to be fearful of the craft. Of course, in 1933, nobody knew about flying saucers. I mean, there had been some unidentified objects, obviously, but nothing of this nature had been in the press, certainly not out of the... out where Mr. Lamb lived. Anyway, the a port opened in the craft, and a being rode down on a beam of light. He, William C., hid behind a tree, and he said from the distance he could see that it was a giant being about 8 foot tall, and it fit the description of Satan with all the trimmings. A horn, a tail, claws, and so forth. Well, by this time he was very apprehensive and tried to get out of there. Anyway, the demon, let's call him that for short, because we don't know if it was the master himself, saw this hunter and started to approach. Well, that's enough to make anybody certainly fall to the ground and pray. And with that, Mr. Lamb started reciting verses out of the Bible. At that point, the demon took off in the opposite direction. Apparently, he was frightened by a few words. They do say, Josh, that words have power. And the demonic being took off. Now, there was snow on the ground, as I understand it, and everywhere that his hooves, because after all, Satan and his minions do have hooves, wherever he put his hooves down in the snow, it would melt around it. He went through a barbed wire fence, melting it as he went along. Now, we don't know what happened to the beast here, because the Mr. 666, because Mr. Lamb took off. Anyway, he wrote about this over and over. He would send zillions of letters out to his friends. He claimed that he had actually seen and had photographs of heaven. To him, God was a bearded man sitting on a throne somewhere and could actually be observed. And when you die, you actually would go to this faraway place. Heaven, in other words, was in another solar system. Well, at that point in my ufological career, I thought this was a bunch of nonsense, to be honest with you. And I still would rank it among the more fringe reports. But over the years, I got to thinking that maybe it's not so peculiar as we think it is, because, first of all, we really don't know what a demon is. In the Bible, it describes, Lucifer as a fallen angel. Well, what is a fallen angel? A fallen angel is a messenger, is an observer, is a personal benefactor. So, actually, when you begin to investigate these things, you realize that there is another realm, an invisible realm, a hierarchy of beings of various different types, not only demons and angels, but you've got fairies and elementals and sprites and so forth, and they exist all around us in a parallel universe which we cannot see. Now, this may seem absurd to some people who have not studied the phenomena as closely as I have, because as I mentioned recently in a review of Brad Steiger's book, this is a long-term phenomenon. You could just not pick up two books and read them and come to a conclusion. You have to observe this over a long period of time, which I believe I have done, having been in the field for I would say this, but close to maybe over 40 years now. I've got to be one of the veterans, me and Brad and Jim Mosley and a few other hangers-on here who have never given up the faith, so to speak. So we don't really know what we're investigating with. So little by little, I decided, you know, geez, you know, people should be aware of this, but not from a fundamentalist viewpoint. Like you hear some of the rhetoric that come out of the fundamentalists, the preachers and the right wing ministers and the TV clergy and so forth. Everything is evil and everything is damnation and we're all going to go to hell. Well, after tonight, perhaps we will.
Well, you're right. And we've got a couple minutes before our first break. What is an alien soul sucker?
Well, I think that term, I probably got that from John Lear. You know, John Lear is this the pilot. I guess he's got every aviation award that has ever been granted or known to man, right? I think well over 100 of them. And John, of course, has given many, many lectures and has been on coast to coast. And he believes that the UFOs are negative forces and that they have a base on the moon. Now, you have to check this out on his site or in my book, because I don't want to misquote him. But supposedly, according to John Lear, they are coming here to harvest our souls and to suck out our souls at the moment of death. Now, if that isn't a frightening thought, I don't know what is. In fact, John Lear says instead of following the light, we should run from it.
Yeah.
A very frightening thought indeed. But the actual term or the title of the book, it is a long title, I realize that, but like I say, words have power. The main title, Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer, is actually based on a book that was written in 1956, and that is part of this 300-page manuscript. And this is a large-sized book. I mean, you're not going to read this in a weekend. You're going to take this at the beach for a month going through all this information. And according to the gentleman whose manuscript we published here, he claims that he, at the time, and this goes back to the early 1950s in California, that's where a lot of the contacts were taking place, if you recall. He says that one day two gentlemen appeared in his auto repair or mechanics garage he was running at the time. And they started telling him this bizarre story about how they needed their spaceship fixed or something to that effect. And he didn't believe them because they looked ordinary. They just looked like you and I, if that's possible. And he said to prove their point, they dematerialized in front of him. They became invisible and then visible again. At one point, he was invited to go on board a flying saucer, and they offered to take him into outer space. Well, he didn't realize where they were offering to take him. Josh, you know where they took him? They took him to hell.
To hell. Okay, well, that's
a hell in a flying saucer.
All right.
And he says that he met Satan, and the world that they took him, the world that they took him to was it was dark with volcanic, you know, with the volcanic.
Okay, let's go ahead and let's stop right there because we got to take a break. But I want to hear more about what hell was like.
Yeah.
Because that's the good stuff right there. Yeah, what is it like to go into hell? We're also going to talk a bit about the Oz factor, about reptilians and demons, the Oz factor as well as Men in Black. Okay. I'm talking to Tim Beckley, and his new publication is called Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer. If you go to speakingofstrange.com, you will find a link to his book. I've got it right here. It's really, really good. Trust me. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We'll be right back here on Speaking of Strange. with P. Warren. And right now we're talking about a round trip to hell in a flying saucer on this La Pernice Knock. It's a new publication by the one and only Timothy Green Beckley. If you go to speakingofstrange.com, you will find a link there where you can learn more about this at conspiracyjournal.com. So, Tim, tell us more about hell when you get to fly there in a flying saucer.
Well, according to the author of this self-published work, obviously I don't think you could get the backing of Doubleday or any of the big companies to put this out. In fact, it's been out of print for so many years. I've seen the copies. It was self-published back in the 50s, going on eBay for $150. So I decided, let me grab this up and put it in this book of ours. It's about 90 pages out of the 300 pages of the book. But Cecil Michael, that's the name of the author of this little self-published tome, and he claims that when they took him to on board the ship, the craft had the giant ports in it, and it was infused with yellow light inside, very blinding light. They got to this planet, and it didn't take long to get there. I guess going to hell for certain people doesn't. But he said when he arrived, the ship landed, and it was a black, bleak, more than any, red planet with a lake of fire in which coffins were floating. There were dead bodies inside the coffins, and they were burning in agony. I mean, this is a real, you know, really far-fetched, you know. You got to take UFOs both as a, as a serious subject, and also a bit of pop culture. There's been so much written about UFOs from all directions that you've got to include it all, whether you believe it or not. You know, I mean, this may seem far-fetched, but I believe to a fundamentalist hearing this, they would certainly agree. Maybe some of them have actually even been there.
Sure.
He actually claims that he met Satan, and they sat down on a smoking rock near what seemed to be a volcano, and they had a little bite to eat, something like a potato or something. I guess.
I did that earlier.
I guess Satan is on a strict diet. The only thing that saved him and returned him to Earth was that he saw a vision of Christ. Now, this, like I say, I'm not a very good Christian boy. I'm more of a paganist myself. Everybody's got the right to believe what they want, and a lot of the things that stories and all in the Bible, I do believe have a basis in lore and mythology, and a lot of this has certainly been proven through archaeological digs and finds. So I don't poo-poo the whole idea. I included in this book not only stories of that nature, but other things that I thought had bearing. The dark side of ufology is what I call it. You know, we hear about the Space Brothers and a sweetness and light and all the things that the New Agers have to say, and that's wonderful. In fact, our next book that we're just finishing up now, that'll be out in a couple of weeks, is called Angels of the Lord. Sean Castile made me write it. He said, "Tim, we're spending too much time on the dark side. We've got to show people that there's a positive side of this as well." So we're taking it from both points of view. I realized that there was this dark element, and I don't know. I made a list of what is part of this aspect of ufology. And it includes the connection between UFOs, demons, and possibly Satan himself that we've described. There's also a vast amount of interest, fascination, a link between Nazism, occultism, and German-made flying saucers. I said earlier, there was this stone-cold belief among most people in the field that flying saucers had to be from outer space. In fact, this is an idea that actually the government secretly fostered in the early days of the subject. They didn't want you to believe in flying saucers at all, but if you were going to believe in some theory, you should believe that they were from outer space and not believe that they were originated closer than, some other galaxy. They tried to poo-poo the subject, but at the same time foster the interplanetary theory. Well, I think it's more speculation. My belief is that a lot of the early UFO crashes at Roswell, Kingsman, Aztec, are really wreckages, are crashes of German-made flying saucers that we were testing. After the close of World War II, we bought a lot of these Nazi scientists and engineers over to this country under the Project Paperclip. And interestingly enough, Josh, where were they located? Where was the first part of the space program set up? In New Mexico. Where were all the UFOs crashing? New Mexico.
Yeah.
Seems to be a strange link there somewhere. Oh, also, too, if you look at the descriptions of what the witnesses saw, most of the craft were, they were not millions of years ahead of us. They had something in the craft that was like aluminum foil, and when you try to crush it, it would just get flatten itself out again. Well, that doesn't seem remarkable. It's not a technology that would be a million years, light years ahead of what we have now. So I think a lot of these crashes were of saucers that were based on the technology that the Germans had brought here as part of Paperclip. Now, this still does have a UFO tie-in, because how did the Germans get plans to build their own flying saucers? They got it through occultism and seances. Back in the as early as 1919, a group of mediums, all female with long hair, very attractive, I must say. Now, they all had long hair, and most people did not at that time, because they thought that their hair would be a good conductor, like an antenna, for the messages from these from outer space. Well, they were receiving these messages at the seance table, which were written down. It's a part of the Vril Society. It's a historical record. It's not something that I sit here and make up. And if you look at the plans for the flying saucers that came through these mediums and channels, they look remarkably similar to the early photographs taken by George Adamski and others in the Southwest of bell and disc-shaped craft. Why is there a similarity there, Josh? I mean, it just seems more than a little bit of coincidence.
We got a couple minutes before our next break. Do you think that there are more sightings happening right now that could indicate more of a demonic presence among those who believe in that sort of thing?
That is so hard to say. There are such a multitude. You know, the thing with UFOs, Josh, you don't know what a UFO is. I mean, are they Brown Mountain Lights, which you have so investigated for years? Are they the same things that were seen recently and perhaps photographed in Jerusalem? You've got to separate the UFOs, and that is what's so hard to do. If you got 10,000 reports, which are the ghost lights? Which are the plasma balls? The ball lightning? Which may be a few of the spaceships thrown in? How about the ones that come from the underground, from the caves or inside the earth? And how about the ones that are misidentification? How do you separate all of this? I remember back many, many years ago when Jim Moseley had his saucers organization in New York, and we had regular meetings. John J. Robinson, who actually is responsible for me taking this photograph of the MIB in Jersey City, was the secretary of the group. We actually took minutes. Isn't that strange, right? And we actually had a computer. He had a computer program. In those days, it was a very primitive form with punch cards. And he entered all this data onto the punch card, something like 5,000 reports. And we realized after trying to analyze the data that it told us nothing. John Keel always said that there were more UFO sightings at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night than at any other time of the week. Well, what does that mean? I mean, you don't know. You can't separate the wheat from the chaff here, and you don't know which is a real UFO and which isn't, and which is a ship from hell, and which one may be from the inner Earth or from outer space. It's an impossible task.
Right.
Now, also, you have to separate the physical sightings, like the ones that are on YouTube where people see lights in the sky, and a lot of them are just that, they're lights. Could be misidentifications, could be ultralight planes going up at night, could be balloons, Chinese lanterns. I guess there are a lot of those. Probably more Chinese lanterns being bought in the name of ufology in the last couple of years than anything else, you know. So it's impossible. But then you've got what I call the low-level reports and the nitty-gritty, where these beings actually materialize in people's homes.
Yeah.
They have repeated abduction experiences.
Well, I tell you what, we got to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, let's talk about those low-level experiences and also the Oz factor, this odd state of mind that people are in when they experience the unexplained, and whether or not Tim Beckley has experienced it. He is the publisher of Round Trip to Hell and a Flying Saucer. Go to speakingofstrange.com and you'll find a link to it. I am Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. Of Strange, the show where the unusual becomes usual, and right now we're talking about a round trip to hell and a flying saucer, UFO parasites, alien soul suckers, invaders from demonic realms. And Tim Beckley, let's get back to what you were talking about before the break, actually. I'll let you pick it up from there, and then we'll continue.
Oh, okay. Well, we were talking about low... I think we started discussing low-level...
Low-level, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of the low-level... Okay, there are experiences where people would go out, and they have... starts out as an ordinary UFO sighting, you know, a light in the sky. Maybe they see it on the next night as well. And then it lands in their back. It seems to be a whole progression is part of their experience. Next thing you know, their home is being invaded by who or whatever. Mysterious beings, often maybe 3 or 4 feet tall, shadowy figures in a lot of cases. They see them fleeting across the room. Maybe they see them in a doorway with the light behind them. In fact, there's some fascinating video that was taken, I think, down in Florida, where a family had been having continuous encounters and experiences in their home where these beings were appearing, mysterious balls of lights being photographed, orbs, things like that. And so they set up a camera, and the camera, a motion camera, you know, so anything that was moving about, the camera would turn on and they'd be able to photograph it. And they've got some fairly, if it's not a hoax, some fairly interesting footage of a couple of materializations in the bedroom. One of them appears to be one of these small gray suckers hovering up near the ceiling. Another one seems to be something that's peeking out of the bathroom doorway and then dematerializes again. So you've got people who start out with just having ordinary, everyday UFO sightings, if there is such a thing, and then all of a sudden they're consumed by this. A lot of them start going into trance. They start doing automatic writing. They'll start playing around with the Ouija board. In fact, there's an episode that's in Brad Steiger's new book, which I reviewed in UFODigest.com. And we talk about the case that both Brad and I investigated many, many years ago about Brian Scott. Brian Scott was a young gentleman in his early 20s who was hiking with a friend of his through the Superstition Mountains in Arizona. Now, Josh, if you know anything about the Superstition Mountain,
oh, yes.
Dozens of people have disappeared there over the years. Their bodies have never been found. Supposedly, there's a lost treasure, gold buried by the Native Americans worth millions, maybe billions of dollars today. Boy, wouldn't we like to get our hands on that. A lot of people would. And apparently they've disappeared while doing so. Anyway, Brian Scott and his friend were doing a little bit of hiking, and all of a sudden they were sucked up into this craft. They were given a physical examination and then let go. Now, okay, so that's happened apparently according to Whitley, Schreiber, and Bud Hopkins and Dr. Jacobs hundreds of times, apparently, if you believe those stories. And I'm a little skeptical about them. I think you got to kind of limit what you believe, what happens under hypnosis. If somebody tells me a story about an abduction and they claim that they remember it and it happened to them and they got scars on their body, or in the case of Carl Higdon, where he had actual physical evidence of his vehicle being moved back into a swampy area where he could have never driven it, and burn marks on his body and so forth. Well, I give that a little bit more credibility. You know, there's a certain thing called the false memory syndrome under hypnosis. So I want to hear the actual physical experiences, and there are enough of them, certainly. And a lot of these people that have these experiences and they start getting these what they call bedroom invaders, they literally go through hell. They might have gone with the fellow who went with the, you know, Satan to this black, bleak world somewhere in outer space. And they find it impossible to get rid of these demonic creatures that utterly consume their life. And in fact, Brad Steiger tells in his book about this case of Brian Scott that we investigated together. He started talking, channeling through another voice. His voice changed completely. And in order to prove that it wasn't just him trying to throw his voice, there was actually a group from SRI, I think it was, that came in and recorded some of his sessions. And then they compared the voice while he was channeling to his normal voice and said it was created. It was somebody else speaking. Also, the orbs were flying around the room, and one time he was sleeping in bed, and the blanket caught on fire. This case is something right out of The Exorcist. In fact, it is The Exorcist. A lot of these stories could easily be put in that term, where people become possessed after they've had a low-level sighting, and then they start experiencing these more bizarre aspects, the dark side of ufology.
Well, you know, there are times when people experience something weird, and they talk about what they call the Oz factor. Now, we just have a few minutes before our next break. What is the Oz factor, and have you ever experienced it?
We were talking about this case of Carl Higdon, the hunter in Wyoming. He described to me, and this was written up in the press at the time, and Dr. Leo Sprinkle was involved in the investigation. To me, it's the best documented report of an abduction and a close encounter that I've ever investigated, and my final report was about 100 double-spaced pages. He was out hunting. Carl was out hunting one morning. Another case of a hunter experiencing something. I guess it's part of that isolation factor. You don't have a lot of people around. You're out by yourself, you know. No other eyewitnesses. And most of the times it seems like these beings don't want a lot of people around. That these experiences are meant just for one or two individuals. Anyway, he was out hunting. and he had seen observed a group of elk off in the distance, not too far away. So he raised his rifle to bag himself an elk, and all of a sudden he claims that the entire atmosphere around him changed. There was no ambient sound anymore. Everything had gone dead. It's like somebody stuck, plugs in his ear or something like that. He got off one round, shot off one round, and the bullet seemed to have struck some invisible force field, because it didn't, the elk were reasonably close, but it struck something and it just fell to the ground. Off beyond this force field, he saw a cube-shaped object, not very large. He said it was maybe about 15 feet in diameter. There was a being or two of them, I believe, outside the craft. They were sort of small and they were humanoid. They were small in stature. The most bizarre thing about them, I think he noticed, and there is a drawing that was made by Mr. Higdon. Not a very good artist, I must say. But they had straight, bizarre hair, kind of like a punk rocker, but more like straw. Eventually, he was taken on board this craft. Now, here's, again, part of the Oz factor. The object, as I said, when it was resting on the ground, seemed like it was only 15 feet in diameter. But he realized when he was inside that it had to be much more massive than that, because inside the craft were several of the elk he was hunting. They were in cages, and apparently they had been sedated. And also there was a whole crew of these strange-looking punk rock hair dude beings. They took him to some other world or someplace else. He never really could say where it was, because they didn't provide him with a map or anything like that. He got there, and it didn't take very long, but where he got to wherever he was going, they took him out of the ship, and they were in a place that was remarkably Earth-like. In other words, he could breathe. He didn't need a spacesuit or anything like that. I think he said the atmosphere was a kind of a different color than we would find on Earth, because they had two suns in the sky.
Huh.
Or maybe it was two moons or whatever. He was taken inside of a structure and up in an elevator, and he described the structure as being very similar to the Space Needle at the Seattle World's Fair, which, of course, is still standing, and you see it in a lot of news broadcastings and stuff, right? It looks like a flying saucer.
Yeah.
He went up to the top of this, and he said he could see outside. Now, the remarkable thing about his observations through this window was that people were moving down on the street level on, like, conveyor belts, just like you get at the airports now, you know, where you don't have to lug your around your suitcase and stuff. You just get on that little moving walkway. And so apparently that's what he saw below. And there were both these beings with the strange hairdo to identify them. And they seem to be walking and talking with Earthlings.
Yeah, kind of like the scene from Men in Black when all the creatures are going in and out. We have to take our last break of this hour, and when we come back, yeah, it's just flown right by. When we come back, we'll have just a few minutes left, and we'll talk with Tim about Round Trip to Hell and a Flying Saucer, why you need to read this book, and then, of course, we have the Dark 30 Hour, when we're going to get into some of the more outrageous news. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange. I wish I was special.
so very special. But I'm a creep.
The final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. Coming up next, the Dark 30 Hour, when we get into, well, some of the more outrageous and controversial news, including our coverage of the Slut Walk. That's right, we were there for the Slut Walk. And as you can see, the stories can go on and on and on, from round trip to hell in a flying saucer, UFO parasites, alien soul suckers, invaders from demonic realms, edited by Timothy Green Beckley and Sean Castile, with all kinds of fantastic contributors, not least of which yours truly. And if you go to speakingofstrange.com, you'll find a link to this book. I hope you will buy it, because it really is the kind of book you can just read and read and read, whether you're on an airplane or chilling at the beach. If you also go to conspiracyjournal.com, you'll find info on this book. So in the final minutes here, Tim, what's the summary? What do you leave people with, you know, regarding this newest work?
Well, you know, there's so much we didn't really get the opportunity to cover. Chris O'Brien, who we interviewed in the book, you know. Oh, of course, he's the co-host of the Paracast, but also very wealth of information on shapeshifters. And investigating these reports, now, of course, the shapeshifter is in mythology. It goes back to even the Greek dramas. You know, there are in the Roman Empire, there's shapeshifters and things that have happened throughout the history. Of course, Dracula was also a shapeshifter, but I don't think he wrote a flying saucer, but that might be our next book. You never can tell, right?
Sounds like a good point.
We also found out, you know, that they could change into beings and animals and orbs and fireballs. And there are even now a host of reports where the objects themselves, the hardware, if we're talking about hardware here, are able to morph themselves. In fact, in this case I just described to the hunter Carl Higdon, here he's looking at a little cube out in the field that's 15 feet in diameter, and when he gets aboard the craft, it's totally different in shape and size. I interviewed two teenage boys who were out on a golf course, I think it was, in Staten Island. This took place many years ago. And they saw a UFO come down in a wooded area. In fact, they showed me branches that had been burnt and some of the trees and all. They looked like there had been indentions. And, you know, it looked like something had happened there at a high level as this object had descended. But they said when they saw the object, it was a ball shape, maybe 10 feet in diameter. And by the time the sighting was over, it zipped away in the sky. It was a cigar.
Well, now, there you have it. I mean, you know, these stories just go on and on and on, and they are all fascinating. Tim Beckley, I cannot thank you enough for being on the program tonight.
Always a pleasure. And next time, let me know about the Slut Walk.
You would feel right at home there, I assure you. When we get back, we'll give you our take on the Slut Walk. In the meantime, go to speakingofstrange.com. And again, it's round trip to hell in a flying saucer. I'm Joshua P. Warren.